Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 2nd of February 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, with me in the studio, Mike Robinson. Well, the weather is not too good. Reports are grey and dingy, so we'll leave it there. We'll get on to the happier subject of international banking.
Yes, so Glass-Steagall back on the agenda in the United States. This is House Representative Marcy Kaptur, Democrat. She held a press conference a couple of days ago to announce that she's reintroducing another Glass-Steagall bill into the House for this session. 26 other members of Congress co-sponsored the bill, including Walter Jones, who has sponsored previous bills on this. Tim Ryan is another one. And interestingly enough, Tulsi Gabbard, who is just back from Syria, back to the United States from Syria. They were all at the press conference. This is what Nancy Kaptur had to say. Sorry, Marcy Kaptur. She said that recently there's been a real uptick in support for restoring the Glass-Steagall Act. 15 state legislatures, including the state of Ohio, have introduced resolutions calling for Congress to reinstate Glass-Steagall. The Democratic and Republican parties enacted Glass-Steagall positions in their platforms. President Donald Trump even endorsed the call for a 21st century version of Glass-Steagall during the campaign statement in Charlotte, North Carolina. We have an obligation to work with them to achieve that. So anybody that doesn't know what Glass-Steagall was, it was legislation brought in the 30s during the financial crash. And it was designed to separate, among other things, separate the banking functions, merchant banking from day-to-day retail banking so that speculative banking wouldn't have such an effect on people's day-to-day lives. And as we mentioned, Tulsi Gabbard is supporting this. She's just back from Syria, gave a fantastic interview to CNN. If anybody hasn't seen that yet, please go and look at that. She's really starting to be outspoken on some more serious issues at the moment. Sean Spicer, who's the White House press secretary, was asked by Bill Jones from EIR where does the president stand with regard to Glass-Steagall? Because as Marcy Kaptur said, he did say that he supported a 21st century Glass-Steagall Act. They got a bit of a non-answer. Does the president still support Glass-Steagall is what was asked. And Spicer responded, the president's position is consistent. What does that mean?
Sounds like a BBC reply.
Yes. Well, in the meantime, of course, Trump trying to get his Treasury Secretary through, and apparently he has been pushed through now by dictatorship, really, because of course if the Senate committee which looks at these issues doesn't particularly agree on a particular candidate, it only takes one senator to sort of put the stops on it. Well, the Republican section of the Treasury Committee weren't terribly excited about that, so they just decided to go ahead to suspend the rules, as they described it, and they just went ahead and pushed him through anyway. So he now goes through to a full Senate hearing, and of course with a Republican majority, he's probably going to end up as the Treasury Secretary. And what's interesting about Steve Mnuchin, I can't pronounce his name, Mnuchin, I suppose is how you pronounce it, he is a hedge fund manager who is completely anti-Glass-Steagall. So it seems that despite the fact that Trump ran on that on his manifesto, it looks like he's probably going to renege on it, but at least Congress trying to make some effort to push it through.
So this one will be interesting to watch, Mike. And there seems to be similarities with the Labour Party and the Bradbury Pound, because, of course, senior members of Corbyn's Labour Party signed the early day motion supporting the idea of a reintroduction of the Bradbury Pound to solve this madness of money from nothing in the United Kingdom. And now we are in the situation where all of a sudden the top tiers of the Labour government seem to be remarkably unenthusiastic to discuss this matter further.
Yes.
So be interesting to watch.
Yes, indeed. So other financial news, Deutsche Bank. Second year in a row in the red, $1.5 billion in the red this time. net loss of 1.4 billion euros, $1.5 billion. Well, it's not really much of a surprise. Most of this, well, it's being blamed on various fines that they've had to pay, lower revenues and restructuring costs. In the report here from Yahoo and any of the other mainstream coverage of this, there wasn't too mention of derivatives exposure as being one of the drivers for it. But, you know, we have said on many occasions that Deutsche Bank is bankrupt, and indeed it is.
I'm very puzzled about this, Mike, because, of course, Deutsche Bank was one of the key banks that funded the political charity Common Purpose. Julia Middleton, the chief executive, gushing in her praise for Deutsche Bank. And indeed, she said all East German bankers were wonderful people. Deutsche Bank's been a big funder. Lehman Brothers, what's happened to them?
Oh, they're dead and gone.
They've gone bankrupt and gone, and now Deutsche Bank seems to be heading the same way. And yet Deutsche Bank was the bank chosen as a model by Common Purpose. This is the model that school children, you know, if they're lining up in teenage years, what job are you going to do? Common Purpose lining up Deutsche Bank as one of the ones to help focus these children on becoming leaders. So
a shining beacon.
Shining beacon to young people. So I'm a little bit puzzled how Julia Middleton can have been so mistaken that the banks she chose as the objects of shining beaconness are now suddenly failing. Could it be the whole thing was phony and a sham?
Yes.
I think so. Well, you are going to come on to Time to Talk, which is about mental health, particularly in Westminster. I'm sorry, I just added that. But let's have a look at what else Parliament has got lined up for us and bring in the family test. Now, this has just been posted on, well, 1st of February, so we're spot on with this. And we think this is very, very interesting when you start to analyse what's going on here. The family test was introduced in 2014 in England. All new domestic laws and government policies must face a family test to make sure they support strong and stable families. The DWP has published departmental advice on carrying out the family test. The family test is not a statutory requirement, and publishing the results is encouraged but not required. Relatively few family test results have been published, leading to criticism that the policy is not yet successfully embedded in all government departments. And at the moment, this is sort of caught betwixt and between. It's not been fully brought in. There's a little bit of dissent. But I think it's very interesting to see what's going on here, because it's still very much in the government mind. And let's bring on, this gentleman, David Cameron. I've chosen the image that we had up yesterday. David Cameron tried to get Daily Mail editor sacked over Brexit. So we know that David Cameron will manipulate the press if he can in order to get his objectives into power. But this is what he said, what he has previously said, sorry. I've said previously that I wanted to introduce a family test into government. Now that test is being formalised as part of the impact assessment for all domestic policies. Put simply, that means every single domestic policy the government comes up with will be examined for its impact on the family. And that was back in August 2014. And this thing is growing in the background. Here's the document that's just been pushed out by the House of Commons publishing organisation, The Family Test. And this bit I find very interesting, because it says in March 2016, implementing the family test, a review of progress 1 year on, was published by the Family and Childcare Trust, Relate and Relationship Foundation, supported by 14 other charities. Now, I think what we've got going on here, Mike, is what you've described as participatory democracy.
Yes.
So voters don't get a say in what's going on here. But people who are working for charities, many of whom are directly funded by the government, they get a say in what's happening.
Yes, there is a fundamental change in what defines government in this country going on at the moment. Charities right at the centre of that. And we've said it many times. With all this charity going on at the moment, it's a wonder there are any problems in this country at all.
Well, this is the point we would want to make on this. Let's see how it goes on. So the Department for Work and Pensions published guidance on implementing the family test. and it consists of five questions. What kind of impact might the policy have on family formation? What kind of impact would the policy have on families going through key transitions, such as becoming parents, getting married, fostering or adopting, bereavement, redundancy, new caring responsibilities, or the onset of a long-term health condition? What impacts will the policy have on all family members' ability to play a full role in family life, including with respect to parenting and other caring responsibilities? How does the policy impact families before, during and after couple separation? How does the policy impact those families most at risk of deterioration of relationship quality and breakdown? When you read those five bullet points, Mike, you can see the family coming under the government microscope. The government needs to know everything that's going on in a family because they need to know that so that they can know what impact they're having.
Yeah.
So if we bring David Cameron back on, because, of course, he's had quite a lot to say about this. This is one of his quotes. So from here on, and this statement was made post the riots in 2011, I want a family test applied to all domestic policy. If it hurts families, if it undermines commitment, if it tramples over the values that keeps people together or stop families from being together, then we shouldn't do it. And that's not enough, because we've got a bit more here. More than that, we've got to get out there and make a positive difference to the way families work, the way people bring up their children. And we've got to be less sensitive to the charge that this is about interfering or nannying. Now, this is the real Conservative Party coming into view here. This is raw fascism, in my opinion, because he wants the state to be into family life, whether we want it or not. If we accuse the government of nanny state, that's going to be steamrolled right over. And we better finish it off because he did have a lot to say on this. We're working on ways to help improve parenting. Well, now I want that work accelerated, expanded and implemented as quickly as possible. This has got to be right at the top of our priority list. And my feeling is that the real meaning here is that we've got to get government control of these families now. And of course, this has been a very strong agenda going on with the Conservative government. And we've got the networks being built up, local authorities integrated with social services, childcare, the police, education, mental health, the state watching every aspect of our lives. This is unbelievably dangerous, Mike, I think.
And they're doing this under a veneer of protecting people's families and looking after people and being warm and cuddly. There's nothing warm and cuddly about this. But the other observation I would make is that, what this does is put a whole new level on the decision in the Supreme Court to crush an in-person scheme in Scotland, because that clearly was a pilot for something that was intended to be rolled out much broader.
Well, of course, we got lots of clues that the named person scheme is sitting in the background ready for England and Wales, and there'll be more on that in due course. We've now got opposition to the Tory party disappearing as Labour is dismantled from within. What are we left with? We're left with a Conservative dictatorship. And I think we can see this being built very quickly. And as we're moving on through the news, we are going to be talking about the police, amongst other things. We can see where that's going.
Yes. Well, this is Time to Talk Day. So it's Time to Talk, Brian. Hashtag Time to Talk. Everything's about Time to Talk. Time to Talk is about time to change, apparently, but we'll come on to that in a second. Let's see what Theresa May had to say when she launched this. Yes, we just heard what she said. Time to Talk is an important day in our national calendar. It's a day when we put the issue of mental health at the forefront of our minds. She said, these problems affect millions of people. An estimated one in four of us has a common mental disorder at any one time. So I just wanted to begin by asking which one in four of this lot? Because here is our current cabinet, our current government, in fact, Theresa May's government, her regime. I'm not sure how many there are there, but let's say there's in that photograph 25 or so. there must be a significant number of those people that are mentally ill, according to Theresa May.
I think there's 28 there. Very quick count from a distance. 28. So this is not looking too good. Possibly five of these people, if we just err a little bit with our statistics.
Right.
Five of those people could be mentally ill.
That's absolutely right. Okay, yeah. So just keep that in mind. So let's see, what else did she say? She said, last month I set out the first steps in our plan to transform the way we deal with mental health problems at every stage of a person's life. I said that the inadequate treatment of these problems was a burning injustice, and that we needed to deal with them not just in our hospitals, but in our classrooms, at work, in our communities. From crisis cafes to online therapy, there is much that we can do to remove the stigma and stops so many people seeking help, and so on. And she particularly focused on two charities, one, Time to Change, and the other one, Heads Together. So let's just have a look at them. Here is Time to Change. They're talking about Time to Talk Day. Do go and have a look at this. And here is the other one, Heads Together, headed up by the royals themselves.
But surely, Mike, they're not saying that these members of the royal family are suffering from mental illness as well? What the blue band is about? If you've got something wrong with you, you wear this blue band?
I'm not sure. Now, look, we are making light of this in some respects, and in a number of other respects, there's nothing to make light of here, because, of course, some people do experience mental illness, and those people should get the help they deserve. But what we're talking about here, what we're hinting at, is effectively the weaponization of mental health.
Yeah.
In the same way that the LGBT community has been used to push forward a political agenda, that's exactly what's going on here with mental health. This is linked to what Brian was talking about with families. This is about government interfering in people's lives to a degree we haven't seen before. If you just go and look at those two charities and look at the organizations that are funding them, the organizations that are backing them up, their supporters and their partners, you begin to see a network of organizations that is involved at a broad political level. And this is the danger of this. So I don't want to understate the effects that mental illness has on any individual or any group of individuals, but I do want to raise a flag here and say that what this is about is much more than helping individuals, because it's not about helping individuals at all.
This actually, Mike, is filling out the mould of big society. If people think that David Cameron's big society has disappeared, it absolutely hasn't. It is being put together step by step. And what big society ultimately leads to is the fact that everything in the country is networked together. So you won't even have a local children's football team without the local authority more or less having a stake in that football club, so that they can keep an eye on the people running the club and what's happening. And this goes all the way through the charity sectors. And of course, it goes a long way to explaining how a very pernicious political charity like Common Purpose can even exist, because actually Common Purpose has become part of the Conservative government regime, all interlinked. It's
yes.
Dangerous stuff.
Absolutely. OK, moving on. This is the UK and NATO up to their tricks. We mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. They were saying that NATO was saying that attempts to hack NATO had increased by 60%, if you remember, in 2016 compared to the previous year. Jens Stoltenberg saying he was extremely concerned about this development and we need to step up efforts in this area. So we are stepping up efforts in this area by signing a cyber defence cooperation agreement with NATO. And it's a memorandum of understanding. It was the ceremony was held at NATO's headquarters, NATO was represented by Ambassador Soren Dunkaru, who's the Assistant Secretary General. We had Paul Chichester, who's Director of Operations of the National Cybersecurity Centre, who said, to meet challenges of cyber threats, the UK government has launched a 5-year national cybersecurity strategy supported by £1.9 billion of investment, Brian. Part of that includes the National Cybersecurity Centre, which will provide a single central body for cybersecurity at a national level, in line with our cyber defence pledge and Strategic Defence, the Security Review and Security Review Commitments, NCSC, will use its intelligence capabilities and world-class technical insights to work with NATO and our allies to better protect our networks. So I'm feeling safer already.
Well, I'm not, Mike, I have to say. I was just looking at the image while you were talking, and of course, over the gentleman's shoulder was a picture of a warship. It did have a gun on it, which is a very positive thing, because, of course, we now know that by 2018, British warships will not have any surface-to-surface anti-ship missiles. They're going to have to rely on guns, which effectively is more or less putting them back into the cannonball age. But at least that ship had a gun on. But don't worry, because the threat is cyber. Well, what could that cyber threat be? We'll come on to that. But first of all, we're just going to put in an advert that we have a lot of new articles up on the UK Column website. So if you haven't visited the website for a while, can we encourage you to do that? And if you like the articles, can we really encourage you to spread the word and share those? And we just draw your attention to this one, which Mike has posted a little while before the news start.
It's Alex's article.
Yes, Mike's just brought it up onto the website, but it's Alex Thompson's article, starting to throw some analysis on what is going on, that we have military veterans having to come outside Parliament to speak out, to shout out their concerns about what the British government has been doing to its own troops. So that might be a particularly interesting article for people to read. But as I say, any article that you like, please can you share it, encourage people to come and have a look at what we're talking about. And I'll just add, while it comes into my mind, it's quite remarkable that sections of the mainstream press that were given copies of David Ellis's article about the handing over of Britain's nuclear deterrent, first of all to the French, but ultimately to the EU under German control, there's been a wall of silence. We haven't had any responses. The illustrious Times has had that material, no comment from their defence correspondent, no comment whatsoever from any of the many mainstream sources that we posted that to. And indeed, it went off to some European newspapers as well. Total silence. Meanwhile, locally, we have Conservative MP Gary Streeter, who's busy saying, oh, he thinks it'll be at least 10 years before we can disentangle ourselves from the European Union. This is Mr. Streeter, who has no concerns about the state of Britain's warships, the breakdown if the water's too warm or they don't have surface-to-surface missiles. He's just very worried that Brexit is going to lead us into a sort of spider's web. Mm. Okay, well, let's come on to the subject of fake news, because the government is getting more and more panicky. And thank you very much to the person who flagged up this. Here we are, parliament.uk website. Fake news inquiry launched. We had a little bit of a close look at this. And we were very interested by this statement. So in inquiry background, it says over the last few years, there have been rising concerns about this perceived trend for the public to distrust traditional sources of news, such as newspapers and broadcasters, and instead turn to the internet and social media, despite the fact that the source of the stories is often unclear and it's not known whether the reports are factually accurate. Well, we were fascinated by that statement where it says the public to distrust traditional news sources, and we'll show you why. We'll move on here to the calls for written submissions, and there's everything about fake news. What is fake news? What impact has fake news on the public? Fake news, fake news, fake news. It's all about fake news all the way down. And we just wondered why the key question wasn't asked. Why have people become so suspicious of mainstream media, newspapers and broadcasters, that it's made them turn to alternative media? So we took the opportunity to phone up the one of the managers of the inquiry. Now, I have to be fair, it was a very young gentleman. I think he was a student who was working as part of the team. But I very gently put this question to him. that the inquiry had said people were turning away from the mainstream media, but that did not, that question did not seem to be part of the inquiry itself. And that, to me, meant that the inquiry was skewed. There was quite a silence there. But his response is, well, we're inviting people to contact the inquiry with written submissions. So if you've got concerns, please write in. At which point we say, what a wonderful opportunity for people to submit accurate factual evidence of the mainstream media, newspapers, the BBC, falsifying information, skewing news reporting, etc. So here is an opportunity for thousands of people to get the evidence, for example, of the BBC's spin in Syria or the Yemen, or in many other occasions, right in front of this parliamentary committee. And if this was to be done in the right way, measured, accurate, evidence-based statements, of course, this would be a huge embarrassment to this committee, which is led by a former Saatchi and Saatchi public relations man. Mm. But it must be accurate. Otherwise, of course, it proves a point, or proves one of the points they're trying to make. Right, I'm going to bring in Melanie Shaw because I've had a lot of communication following our update yesterday. We said that Melanie basically was now out of solitary confinement. She was on a remand wing. This, of course, is a huge boost to her because she can interact with other human beings and she gets time out of her cell. But this isn't by no means the end because, of course, Melanie still faces further charges on the 25th of this month. And we'll keep you posted on that. And let's remind ourselves that, of course, Melanie whistleblew on Beechwood Home. She said, are you all right, Mike? You're dying slowly. It's all right. And she said that basically not only were children abused at Beechwood Children's Home, but that children were killed there. What did the local authority do? They demolished the home. And we know that no full police forensic investigation was carried out. So let's remember this was all done under the watch of then Home Secretary Theresa May, the very same lady that seems to have been in post as documentation relating to child abuse got, well, it got lost.
Yeah.
Got lost. So what sort of man have we got in Westminster? Now, I briefly mentioned this gentleman the other day. I'm going to bring him back into the frame. His name's David Morris. He's a Morecambe MP. And a gentleman had written to him about Melanie Shaw. He said in his first line, as you will no doubt understand, it's inappropriate for me to comment on an individual case and imperative that we respect the independence of the judiciary and respect the judgment of the court. So for him, it's quite clear all of our courts are running perfectly happily, even though we know that we have courts acting as places of business. We have courts stealing property under rules for court of protection. And of course, courts stealing children out of any form of jury, out of sight of any jury or press or the public. He says, I believe that prisons should punish people who commit serious crimes. I'm not sure whether he's talking about Melanie still. I think he is, by depriving them of their most fundamental right, their liberty. But they must also be places of safety and reform. For too long, reoffending rates have remained too high and cost society $15 billion a year. So he's not interested in the reports that clearly Foston Hall, where Melanie is not a safe place. What he does is gives the rest of that page to an advert for the government's policy for more prisons and 2,500 cheap prison staff. Well, this is the key bit we should bring in. He's no interest in the concerns of his constituents regarding the treatment of child abuse whistleblowers. I don't think he's got any concerns about that at all. He's just pumping out the party line. And it goes on to page two. And what do we end up with on page two? This year, we will begin the process of submitting planning applications for new prison sites, starting with Wellingborough and Glenn Parver. Thank you again for taking the time to contact me. So this is the quality of our MPs. They do not care if the law is being broken, if very vulnerable prisoners are being harassed, bullied, intimidated. Our MPs have simply said they don't care. Well, have a look at this man. This is his Twitter page. It's very big on him. So there's a lot of images all about him and what he's doing. But I was intrigued to find this. And UK Column has blacked out the faces of these very young children. So it's David Morris MP saying, I had a brilliant morning speaking to the school council. Some fantastic questions from the children. And I'm going to caption that by saying he's happy to speak to these young children, but not to protect them in any way. So I get a deeply unpleasant feeling out of this, that we have MPs going to schools, representing themselves as upstanding members of the public. But when a child abuse survivor comes forward saying how they were raped at the age of 3 years old, he doesn't want to know. And I'll just add here that, of course, it's very difficult to get in touch with Mr. Morris. I had at least 3 phone calls, not answered, no answering machines. And when I sent an email, I got an automatic response saying, well, not available. Mm. So this is probably a very timely article that's come up. Basically, the McCanns have lost their appeal in Portugal. This is what the judges said. They ruled that the Portuguese policeman Amaral's exercise in his freedom of expression was not considered abusive and was within admissible limits in a democratic and open society, which excludes the illegality of possible damage to the honour of the McCanns. So I think what the judges were saying, correct me if you think I've got this wrong, Mike, but the judges were saying, we think free speech is rather more important than the reputation of the McCanns. And as a result of this final judgment, the McCanns could now be faced with huge costs. But more importantly, people can now freely read the really good investigative work that that Portuguese policeman did in the case.
Right. So if we remember, they sued him originally for publishing his book, which made certain allegations against them. And they won their original case, which awarded €450,000 to them or so. He then appealed and that original case was result was overturned and the McCanns then took that to the Supreme Court in Portugal with this result. So this I think this is an entirely appropriate result under the circumstances.
Absolutely. Now, in that Mirror article, it went on, and this was part of it. Could cops be given more time to search for missing Maddie? Police make the desperate search for Maddie McCann. And I'm utterly fascinated in this because, of course, this is a multi-million pound operation to find one child. Now, very sad, Maddie McCann has disappeared, but one child. So let's remind ourselves that when British press has been reporting that hundreds of child refugees have vanished since arriving in UK for the protection of this country, prompting trafficking and abuse fears, there is no evidence of any coordinated investigation into their disappearance at all. And the Metropolitan Police will simply not speak to the UK column to explain why there's this huge difference. Well, it's not one report on this. There are many reports. Here is The Guardian. They're actually talking about 360 children, many of whom are Syrian children. British government, just not interested. Is this racial discrimination, Mike, that we can look for one little white girl, but they're not interested in Syrian or Muslim children?
Quite possibly.
I think it could be. And let's remind ourselves that when a Metropolitan Police whistleblower spoke out, actually saying that the Metropolitan Police, politicians, local authorities, government ministers and charities were covering up the abuse of children, the policing minister simply took no action whatsoever. So we're going to ask this question. We'd like help from our audience as to what's going on here. millions spent on Maddie McCann, nothing spent on the search for Syrian children. So we say why, and it will be wonderful if our wider audience would actually be asking written questions to appropriate people, such as the Prime Minister, Home Secretary, and the Metropolitan Police, as to why we have this mismatch. Is this racial discrimination? We can look for white children, but we can't look for these Syrian children and other children that have come in from the Middle East. Well, we can't turn to the church for help because, oh dear, the Archbishop of Canterbury is in a little bit of a sticky spot, apparently. He is completely unaware, of claims that one of his colleagues at a Christian summer camp had been subjecting boys to savage, sadomasochistic beatings. Now, I've read the article very quickly, but I think it's saying that in his very early days, as a very young man, Mr. Welby was at the same camps. He didn't know anything about this, but when the church did know something about it, what did they do, Mike?
Nothing.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So the church had failed terribly by not reporting the abuser, Mr. Smith, to police after he was accused of carrying out a string of horrific sadomasochistic attacks in the late 70s. It was all a terrible mistake. Nobody knew. It was all an accident, except when we bring this on the screen, because, of course, this lady suffered horrific abuse in a Church of England home for girls, raped, drugged unconscious, sometimes for days at a time. And yet when she took her documentary evidence and evidence of the other girls who were abused to the Church of England, what they did is ignored her, threatened her, warned her off, delay, and then they paid her a pittance in order to shut up. Mm. So if anybody would like to read more, you can now get the Kendall House report off the internet. It's an extremely clever document. Encourage people to go and have a look at it. These are some of the recommendations: that there should be a public apology to those victims. They should apologise for the length of time it took to get the commission going. We apologise for the length of time we've covered up. And they should make copies of this report. So this is all stall delay, apologise. And if I bring this in, this is a clue to what's going on here, because it's difficult to see here, but you have the body of the report, but there are no conclusions, Mike.
Ah.
So you have a sort of detailed description which tells you what sort of crockery was in the pantry cupboard, and then suddenly it jumps to recommendations. There's no conclusion. If I had produced a report like this during my time in the Navy, I dread to think what would have happened to me. But of course, this has been done in order to help cover up what has gone on. And of course, we know Welby is not to be trusted because he's consistently refused to acknowledge satanic ritual abuse in the Church of England, even when the evidence has been put in front of him. It's a pretty appalling state that we've got into at the moment. And if we do have any Christians watching our programme today, I'm going to say it's up to you to hold the Christian church to account. This is nobody else's problem. This is the Church of England. If you call yourself a Christian, you should be first in the queue to call Archbishop Welby and his team to account.
Okay, policing in this country. So this assault on officers highlighted the Parliament is the headline from the Police Federation. And they're saying that members of Parliament from all parties were given a presentation on the extent of assaults in the police and the value of spit guards against during a visit from the Police Federation of England and Wales yesterday. The delegation was informed by Halifax MP Holly Lynch, which is calling for tougher sentencing for those who assault the police. So we've got to sentence people tougher if you assault the police. And they were shown a hard-hitting video. So that's all very good. Now, Holly Lynch is going to introduce a 10-minute rule bill in the Commons next Tuesday, which is the 7th of February, calling for tougher sentencing for those who assault emergency services workers. So already this is being spun a little bit to be extended to emergency services as a whole rather than just police. But let's focus on the police. It will also call for a change in the law to make those who spit at police to provide a blood sample to reveal whether they're carrying harmful diseases. So this is all really bad. The police are very upset about it. And this fits in with this infographic that they've produced, assaults on police. 23,394 officers have been assaulted in England and Wales in the last year. That's 2,000 a month, 450 a week, 64 a day, one every 22 minutes, they say. Right. And I'm just going to say, you know, why is this happening? Police need to stop behaving like thugs. They need to, you know, they need to sort of gain respect from people through, well, let's think about what they might do. They might know their job for a start. It's rare that they
know the law.
Know the law, do their jobs. Do their jobs no matter who an allegation is made about, no matter what level of society they come from, no matter how much pressure is coming on them from higher up to do their jobs. Understand the law, as you say, so that if they're asked, for example, if they're asked to act on behalf of a corporation, maybe at a fracking protest, should we say, if we're looking at the news in the last couple of days, that you uphold the law instead, to remember that you're a peace officer, not a corporate enforcement officer. Look like a human being, not like a tattooed thug. Police, as we say, policing is about mutual respect. If the police have lost the respect of people, then perhaps crying to Parliament and begging them to enforce respect through legislation isn't going to help. And in fact, that approach is probably going to make matters much worse.
Yeah, I think something very devious is going on here, Mike. We know that the police are in mega turmoil at the moment. I'm going to stick on the child's abuse issue. At the moment, I've got police officers saying there's a war going on because police are, some police, the decent ones, are saying we are just not going to accept this. That, of course, the abuse and murder of children is being covered up by senior police officers. We've now got lower ranks saying they're not going to put up with this anymore. We've got decent senior officers saying they're not going to put up with it. How serious is this? I can tell the audience today with total confidence that police investigations in central London are now investigating the fact that people, I believe children, but I'm certainly going to say young ladies, were taken to venues within police buildings, so not necessarily police stations, but interview complexes where they were raped. So we now have investigations about the abuse of people by the police while they were effectively using police facilities. This is utterly vile stuff. And our Met Police whistleblower has already said that senior police officers actively covered up investigations into the trafficking, prostitution of death of children in London. So the police getting scared, I think. There are certainly police getting scared. So what do you do when you're scared? You run to the government. I need to be armed to protect myself. You need to protect us against those nasty people, the public. Well, I think public anger has got new levels to reach when they finally discover what some police officers have actually been doing. But I think it's also leading, and this is my prediction, Mike, we're now going to see the police saying, actually, I think we need to be armed. We should be able to carry our weapon, even if we're off duty for our personal safety. So there's a prediction for you. But why is this coming about? Because the lid is coming off the utter, I've got to use the word filth, that is inhabiting the top of the police structure. It's organised crime and it's child abuse, child trafficking, films, prostitution. At least this information is coming to the surface now.
Okay, Brexit then. Well, unfortunately, the white paper hadn't been published before we came on air, so can't comment on that yet. But I just wanted to have a little laugh at Tim Farron, of course, leader of the Liberal Democrat Party. He wants to rally people. He wants the Liberal Democrat Party to become the real opposition, because, of course, they are the only party that is sort of with one voice saying we should remain within the European Union. And so they're trying to get some momentum behind that. He said, we're not going to give up. We didn't give up in the 50s and 60s when we were in the minority. We're not going to give up now. Why should we? Nigel Farage never gave up. I think he did.
Well, he did give up after he'd done the job of leading 17 million voters into a cul-de-sac by claiming that Brexit had been achieved. Well, of course, we know it. But amazing that it's Mr. Farren, the man who also doesn't appear to give a fig for those 360 missing children, not his responsibility, not in his constituency, doesn't care. Mm. So we'll just say once again, you ask what you can do. And we're going to say that there's all sorts of things people can be doing at the moment. You can be taking on the government over fake news. You can be bringing the errors, omissions and propaganda of the BBC and the mainstream news to the attention of that committee. That's an extremely important job. Don't do it with half evidence. You must have the proper evidence and it's got to be good quality. You can be emailing, complaining, shouting about what's happening with the children. And of course, if you've got family members who are working within the police, talk to them, educate them. There's all sorts that you can do. But we need a lot more action by viewers and listeners because the criminals are running Britain.
Absolutely. And the key word in that lot, I think, is organise.
Organise.
Yeah.
Indeed. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I hope we will have David Scott with us. We were unable to have David Ellis with us this week as he's been exceptionally busy. If you haven't read his article on the nuclear deterrent, please look on the UK column website. And finally, if you like what we do, please subscribe because we can only do what we do with your help. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.